Hello everyone and welcome to the 57th episode of Making It Women in Film. My name is Evita and I'm a writer, lover of film and the host of this podcast, which features weekly interviews with women working across the film and TV industry in front and behind the camera. Now this week I got to talk with the English-Australian everything woman Nicola Quilter. And when I say everything, I mean it. From having a recurring role on the iconic Australian soap opera Home and Away, to starting her own fashion label, being a musician, producing shorts, and now writing her own television show, Combustione. We talk about everything from wild moments of being a telecelebrity, having a stalker, moving away from acting into creating, self-discipline and letting go of judgment, the paranormal, and so much more. It was such a creative, enlightening conversation that touched on everything this podcast is meant to, so I dearly hope you enjoy it. As always, thank you for listening to our show and supporting us in our journey to amplifying women's voices. You can follow us on Instagram for more content in between episodes and check out the show notes for any links mentioned throughout. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for your love. Thank you for taking this moment to reflect with us over a nice cup of coffee through time and space. Enjoy. Hi, Nicola. How are you doing this evening? I'm like so happy that we are actually putting this up, even though you're in Australia and I'm up here in Scotland. How's your day been?
It's been great. I've been playing with kids on the beach. It's been super sweet. I mean, I got up at 5 and did a whole lot of work, and then I did a couple of meetings, and then I came up to the northern beaches in Sydney to see my sister and her two little kids who are like toddlers, which you may or may not hear in the background at some point. But no, it's been really lovely, beautiful.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, I mean, Nicola, you've done a lot of things and had a very interesting path. When you look through everything you've done, from writing to directing, acting, like music, it's like immediately evident that you're a very creative person, wouldn't you say?
I think there's only ever been a creative pathway for me. I don't know. Yeah, I'm probably totally unemployable outside the arts. Started as a kid when I was sort of 8, or I mean, I actually, my mother took me to the theatre when I was 4 to see Annie. And I turned to mum and I went, "That's what I'm going to do." And she went, "Yeah, right." And possibly never really changed my mind in some respects. I mean, I've been around and in front of the camera and behind the camera and things, but yeah.
So how old were you then, do you think? Like when creativity first was
I was 4 when I saw Annie, and that was what I wanted to do. There was some sort of button that was switched on with me, which is, you know, it's kind of a fun show. And I used to write songs, which I didn't know if they could be songs. That's where it sort of started, and perform in front of the family. And later I joined a professional theatre company at 12, or I think I was 11, but I had to be 13 legally, but I sort of lied. I was in bands and I had braces and things on my teeth, and I had to be 18 and, you know, was lying to get into the clubs and be able to perform and things. So I'm sure they knew. But yeah, I've always been a creative.
Yeah. So you were kind of like a theatre kid like that.
Yeah, but I have a nurse mother and a doctor father, and neither of them really wanted me to do that. You know, like, it's not they were anti, but they wanted me to have a proper career.
Yeah, that's always interesting when you have like those kind of stronger influences in other directions, and yet you just, were there anything that they tried to make you do that you were just like, nope?
No, they were pretty good. I mean, I went to fashion school for a minute and they were happier with that because they thought that was at least they could understand fashion. So, but then I, unbeknown to them, I quit halfway through the year. Well, I did. I saw her out the year and auditioned for the three premier drama schools in Australia, but I'd already been acting by that point. I got in, so I kind of went there, but I'd already been acting for a long time, so
yeah. It wasn't a big surprise.
Not really. They weren't that, dad particularly wasn't particularly happy that I left fashion school, but you know, they've all been incredibly supportive, really. I don't think they had a choice.
Yeah, of course. Amongst your acting endeavours is a role, Donna Bishop, from the long-running Australian soap opera Home and Away. How did this happen? Like, this is a while ago, but what was the audition like?
Actually, I did Home and Away twice, so I did it when I was super young. a different character. And then I did it again when I was a little bit older. And actually, I actually did a really good audition. Like, that was, I remember at the time, you know, some auditions don't go well. You do better in some things and not others. But that audition, I had this really meaty audition role, which was a storyline towards the end. They knew where they were going with a character, which was a domestic violence case. And actually, it was a really terrific audition piece. And I remember kind of walking around the city and preparing all morning. And I'd got all the lines down before that. And then I remember I came in to Liz Mullen as the casting agent, and the producer of the show was there, and they tried to talk to me, and I was so sort of involved with the character that I just said, look, can we talk afterwards and can we do the audition? Because I was quite psyched up for the part, but it was quite a big kind of emotional part. And I know that sounds funny for sort of soap operas and things, but it really was quite a big scene. And I remember just really hitting it. Like, I did actually just hit it. You don't always in an audition, but I really did hit it. I did a good audition. The next day they told me I had it.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting. And of course, like, Home and Away is long running. I mean, it's like 33rd season or something like that. Like, it's been there in Australia. What was that show like? What was the soap opera kind of scene like in terms of showbiz and entertainment?
A huge thing for me, because you're working in multi-camera for the first time. I had done a little bit. You're working multi-cam, and there were vision switching, so you knew you had to kind of keep an eye on which camera was on. You know, and it's so fast, so you're having to learn pages and pages and pages and pages of dialogue. There's a really quick turnaround for every scene. In some ways, a baptism of fire, because people tell you stuff, but they don't tell you everything. So, you know, like, I remember a lot of the older actors would be like leaning away from me when I was in a scene with them. It's because I was standing in the light. And it wasn't nasty. They were just trying not to have to retake the scene. You know, they were professionals and they knew what they were doing. I didn't. So, you know, and I remember coming in one day and had this big scene, and I'd learned it all, and I was up all night stressing about it. And this is really early on, and everybody else was on different coloured pages. And that, so because in television, you know, drafts go through different colours, and, you know, you're meant to look in your pigeonhole and find them, but for whatever reason, either I didn't see them or I didn't know or whatever, and I was on the wrong colour pages and my whole scene had changed. And, you know, that whole freak out of like, oh, my God, how am I even going to learn this in time? But you kind of somehow, you have to, so you kind of do.
Yeah. No, of course. Like, that's, I mean, a huge adjustment to something that's so.
It's a baptism of fire. And I don't think people who haven't done a kind of a soap at some point in their life don't really appreciate how quick it is and how hard the writers are working and the crew and the actors. Everyone's just trying to turn this stuff around, because we were doing 5 episodes a week. So, you know, it's a huge amount.
Yeah. No, that's, I feel like television, perhaps especially something like soaps, are not really, like, the effort is not really that acknowledged.
And you know, the whole, you know, costume department trying to kind of get all those scenes together quickly, and the writers too, you know, having to adjust stuff if someone's sick, or, you know, I broke my foot at one point and everyone had to readjust the scripts and I had to kind of swing into a camera move looking like I was moving. And it's a tough gig, you know, and people don't realise. And it's great training ground. There's lots of people who've come out of soaps who've done really amazing things because they've had, you know, a lot of time in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely. What would you say was the most challenging part about working on that particular show?
It's speed. That's definitely the most challenging thing. And also, you're unprepared for the kind of notoriety too. So there wasn't kind of a, well, maybe there was, but I don't remember being sort of cribbed about, you know, hey, everyone's going to know who you are. And yeah, just the kind of the new invasion of privacy. And you can't complain about it, because that also gives you work. But you, at the same time, you have to get prepared for, you know, people reacting to you differently, whereas you were just a person on the street before and you suddenly aren't. That is a big thing when you're a kid.
No, definitely. Are there any like experiences that stick out to you and you're like, I did not like expect that this was going to happen?
When I was doing Home and Away, I was also doing a concert for East Timor. I didn't know what I was doing either. I was very, very young. Somebody said, can you do this concert? There was a bigger thing in that a guy called Gregor Jordan, who made Buffalo Soldiers, took me on the back of his motorbike to see a film called Death of a Nation, which was a John Pilger film about East Timor. And I didn't want to go because it was a sunny day and I'd been working 7 days a week and it was my only day off. Anyway, I was so moved that I went home and wrote this song called Cry Freedom. And 2 days later, we're in the studio with all these session singers singing it. But the long story about that was that people approached me, could I do a concert? And I just kept saying yes to stuff. I was so naive and so young. All through that period, there was things kind of happening that were really amazing that you don't know when you're really young. You know, you don't know how amazing this, and because you're naive, you just say yes. And you don't realize how difficult things might be. And that naivety kind of gets you through in a sense, in that you can do things like a 3-day concert like I did, not knowing what you're doing because you're naive. Anyway, during this concert, I negotiated a deal. I don't remember how I did it, but I negotiated a deal with Qantas to fly all the artists in at some sort of discounted price. And I didn't know how I was going to pay for it. So I was just putting it all on my credit card. In the middle of the night, Michael Hutchins called me. And I'd had a stalker, which comes back to Home and Away. I'd had a stalker who used to call me and I didn't believe it was Michael. So I hung up on him 3 times. And eventually he said, no, it really is me. Don't hang up. And he was calling from the south of France and he said, I'd like to help you with this concert, East Timor. And can I sign some T-shirts? And I was so young and naive that I said, no, I need you to pay for all the flights. And he said, how much is it? And it was like 20 or 30 grand. And I put it on my credit card. And he said, okay. And 2 days later, the money arrived and he never got any credit for that. And he put the money on my card and nobody ever knew that. So it was kind of a special time in that when you have a tiny bit of notoriety and you're doing things and you're working naively, sometimes there are these kind of moments where other people participate in your life in a way that you can't even imagine. So those are the sorts of things that were happening at that time for me. But the media never knew any of that. Michael never took any credit for it and it was never known that he did that. So there were a lot of spin-off things that were happening that not many people knew about that I was doing at the same time and that were quite profoundly life-changing. That not necessarily because of the show, but part of me being around, having a tiny bit of a profile, mm-hmm, probably.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you just want to gloss over that stalking part. That just...
So I did gloss over that. So Melissa George and I were on the show together and we both had this stalker at the time and Woman's Day rang and said, we're going to run a piece on this. You can either participate or not. So we thought we'd try and look empowered. So we did the piece. But actually what they ran was this terrible picture of me looking over my shoulder, looking really scared in some cafe, which I don't even remember where they got the piece of footage. And the reason we did it was that somebody said to us that we should look empowered and that we weren't frightened, because what people who are stalking you want is some sort of reaction and to be frightened. Anyway, that backfired because they ran a picture of me looking really scared. We don't really know what happened, but he, and I can't say what he used to say to me on the phone, but somebody was going through my mail and I was in a very secure building with locks on the mailboxes and stuff. So they were getting into the building somehow. And then separately, when I entered my building, my apartment was on the harbour and it looked at the water and there were apartments that could see in and there were no hang-ups on my answering machine, but this guy would ring whenever I entered the apartment and he would say what he wanted to do to me. And, yeah, I'm not going to tell you, but yeah, it wasn't a great thing, because you start to look at people around you in the gym and different places and think, oh, my God, that guy's staring at me. Is that the guy? You get a bit of paranoia.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can imagine a lot of probably actresses in particular experience something like that. It's kind of surprising that there isn't some sort of, real protection against those things.
Well, we went to the police, but there was nothing they could do until there was something happens. I don't know if it's changed now, but that's how it was at the time. Well, I was led to believe that there was nothing. We didn't have anybody that we knew who it was. there was no violence against me. It was verbal. Of course. But it did make me very paranoid for a while, actually.
Yeah. No, I think that would make anyone paranoid. That's...
He could obviously see when I was entering my apartment. We didn't know where he could see it from because, you know, there was no hang-ups on the answering machine. And so he was obviously either in the building or could see into the building and had access. So it was pretty freaky. Nothing actually happened. And weirdly, it just disappeared. There was a guy who Melissa and I met at a party who said he was this guy called Chris from a show called Hey Dad. He was the grown-up child star. And we'd hang out with him and we never thought to question him. And it turned out that he was a complete fraud and he'd made a hell of this guy's life. Like, he was never bad to us. He had made a hell for this guy, Chris, from Hey Dad. I can't remember the surname. I don't think I ever saw the show, but he was quite well known at the time, the little boy. And this adult looked a little bit like the grown-up version. And apparently he'd taken out all sorts of credit cards and hired all these fancy cars that he was always turning up in this guy's name. And he'd sort of lived off being this guy. And he wasn't this guy. More fool us, I guess. But there was a lot of weirdness around celebrity and around people's perceived notions of people working in television.
Yeah. How did it feel to kind of, I mean, I don't know, as a kid you probably did have your own stars and celebrities and things like that, and go from the other side, like seeing that perspective?
Well, I think more for me, because I was so young when I first wanted to act, I think that it was more that I would be auditioning for stuff and I'd see the same girls in the waiting rooms. And they were getting the roles over me. There was a girl who's really lovely called Nadine Gardner, and she was a great actress. She'd been acting a long time, even as a kid. And I'd always get her best friend. We'd go for the same roles and then I'd get the best friend role. So I don't think, and she was really lovely to me, and she's a really good person. And then one day she was doing something else and then I got a lead role. But I don't know. I think it's so complicated, all of that notion of people's perception of who you are and who you really are as a person. You know, you can never live up to the expectations of somebody who has a mythology that they've created in their head. You know, we're all the same, really. We're just people.
Yeah. It's. I think I find, like, the concept of fans and... like that, like fandom culture, really interesting, because like where does the line go? Because on one hand you're paid to act, but you're also an actress. Like, that's the profession, and then there's the job. Being an actress, like as a title, is almost in of itself a job without the acting part, right? Like all of the...
I really liked the work. I wasn't as good at being famous, or not that I was particularly famous. I'm just infamous maybe, but I wasn't so keen on any kind of status celebrity-wise and having my privacy invaded. It's probably why I became more involved behind the camera. I appreciated the fact that any kind of notoriety you have gives you your work. You know, that's a real thing, you know, and I don't begrudge. I'm glad I did everything I did, and I pay respect to any of the jobs I've had that have helped me in any respect. You know, I'm not one of those person who goes, oh, I did this and I'm not proud of it. I think, you know, everything builds a picture to who you are and everything makes you who you are. And it's really hard work on those shows, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To wrap up the Home and Away saga of your life, what was the most rewarding experience?
I think the finale, when my character left, was this domestic violence kind of storyline. And that was, I think it was really well shot. I think it was pretty well written, actually. And I think I was fairly good in it. And I think it's kind of that, when that thing comes together, you know, where you're doing something that feels like it's kind of means something. And storyline was well written and it was shot well. And it's one of those great things where a sort of a plan comes together. And it was just before I left. So I think that's probably the most rewarding part. Being on a show like that is a personal journey. It's not the public one. It's one of trying to learn the lines really quickly, being thrown in the deep end. You know, like when I say people are leaning because I was in their light, that's because the older guys have been on the show for 10 years, you know, and I didn't know what I was doing. And you learn a bit of craft, you learn some technique, and, you know, you learn a little bit about how to deal with media a little bit. Back then, there wasn't really this media training that there is now. And I think it's great that for young people, there probably is more kind of a system. There's more a structure around people. I imagine.
I mean, gotten even more invasive with social media and things like that, where it does.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was just like you're on the show, deal with it. You know, there was no real, I don't remember there being any media training or what to expect or anything. You know, you just did it and dealt with
it. Yeah. My God. An experience for sure. And that was a lot of the acting. Then you've kind of moved on to more of the producing, directing, writing side of things. When did that happen? I know you took a little bit of a break from like kind of the entertainment scene.
I started a small fashion label, and I had been a musician, and I made records, and I shaved off all my hair and went out with a quite a loud, ugly rock band and toured a bit, and, you know, it was a bit radical. And then I think about 10 years ago, I started to, maybe 8-9 years ago, I started to write. We were writing a sitcom, and the team I was with, you know, we were kind of, it takes a long time to get these shows up and going. And then one of them said, I think it was Ronald, said, let's just make a film. And so we just went and made a short film, and we made it, and I thought, oh, well, that's too hard. I'll never do that again. And got into lots of festivals. And then I started to really enjoy the festival people and the filmmaker side of things. And that kind of set me on a path of kind of wanting to write and direct, you know. And so it's sort of gone from there, really. Then I did a couple of short films which weren't particularly good because they were too long, and were me really being quite experimental. After that, I started to produce for other people because I thought, well, maybe I need to learn what other people do and watch what other directors do. Out of that experience, I kind of found that what I realized was that, having come from an acting base, that potentially I was a bit better at dealing with actors than a lot of the guys who'd come from commercials who were directors, and they were all guys, really, that actually I knew a little bit more than I thought I knew. I think women tend to think that they don't know before they kind of do a lot, and I think guys tend to be a bit more gung-ho and kind of think they know before they actually know. Not in all cases, but that's a sort of a pattern that I see. And I think women have to step up a little bit. It's a bit of that, and it's also men could maybe learn a little bit more before they set up and do things. So it's not a bad thing. It's just different ways of being. So, yeah, I produced for a lot of guys, quite a lot of shorts and commercials and band promos and things. At the same time, I was always writing. And writing's something you can do, which doesn't cost anything but your time. Whereas, you know, making films costs a lot of money. So I spent a lot of time writing, and I became very disciplined about that. So, as I said to you just before we came recording, you know, I usually get up at 5 and I write till 9, and then I do some exercise, and then I come back and I write. And then in the afternoons, I kind of script edit for other people or do whatever meetings I need to do. I'm pretty disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that definitely sounds like it. I think right now, especially these past few years, it's kind of been difficult to set up a routine because everything changed and everything is constantly changing. But writing is something that doesn't really change that much. Like the practical side of getting something made is a different story, but writing itself is just sitting down.
And I think that there's a beautiful TED talk by Elizabeth Gilbert, which I really liked, which is, she talks about, you know, turning up, and she also talks about saving the artist. And one of the things that she talked about, which I think is so beautiful, you can find it anywhere, it's quite a popular TED talk, but she talks about how, yeah, pre the Renaissance, an artist was visited by a genie, and if the genie was good, your work was good. If the genie was bad, your work was bad, but either way, you couldn't take credit or you couldn't be depressed. It wasn't your fault. You just had to turn up and let the genie come through you. And then in the Renaissance, they put the genie inside the human being and called it the genius. And she thinks that's where everything went wrong, because then if your art isn't any good or well received, then you're a failure. And if you're good, your ego is inflated. So I kind of like that idea that I turn up, and I turn up at 5 and I let my genie visit me, and it's my responsibility just to be there. It's not my responsibility to judge it or figure it all out. And maybe it sounds silly, but I really believe that. It's like when people write songs, you know, sometimes you wake up and there's a song already formed, and then there's some things you work on endlessly and they're never great. I feel a bit lucky at the moment, and I think my genie is really good at the moment.
Yeah. Tell me about that. How does it feel when you're writing right now?
I'm excited to wake up at 5 a.m., which is something I never thought I'd say because I'm naturally a night owl. Yeah, I mean, I'm not strict about it. So if I wake up at 6, I wake up at 6. I don't set an alarm.
Oh, my God, you don't set an alarm and you naturally wake up at that point. That's even more impressive. That's discipline.
I didn't. At the beginning, I didn't because I'm naturally seeing fire at 5 a.m. going to sleep. My more natural pattern. But I felt that what was happening in the nighttime for me was just a lot of mucking about, probably drinking and going out, and I wasn't being very productive. Not that I was never productive. I would do the work, but later in the day. But I felt there was a kind of a discipline at that time of the morning where nobody else calls. You are alone, and in England it's dark in the winter. And there's a kind of a cocoon-like state that you're in where you're not judging things because you're half asleep. You know, there's a kind of dream-like state you're in. And when you write things in that state, you write things that you wouldn't construct when you're more awake. And it's not that all writing should be free-form, but if you've already made a plan about the work you're going to do and a structure and you kind of know your ending, you don't always have to, but if you know that, then there's a kind of a magical thing that happens when you're not quite as judgmental. And I think when you're not really awake, you're still in that dream thing, then sort of a magical thing happens rather than the more structured, linear, I'm going to do this, then it has to go here and here and here, which is, I think, when you start to wake up more around 10 o'clock in the day, you start to be more like, so I have a different process. I do the much more creative stuff really early, and then I do the more structured, calculated stuff and the editing a little bit later. And then I tend to, if I'm script editing for other people, I do that in the afternoons.
That's really interesting. I loved the way you described that, like, dream-like flow and not judging what comes out of you, because I think there can be a lot of, I don't know, writing is an interesting thing, because I do, like, as a writer myself, I do find that it's something that just comes to you. And like, I'll write up, you know, some sort of structure, I'll have some sort of idea, but at the end of the day it just has to kind of go through me, and then I can review it later. But if I start reviewing what it is I'm writing sentence by sentence by sentence, then I never get anywhere,
because it's you're judging yourself mm-hmm. before it's happened.
Mm-hmm, exactly. You don't know where it's leading, and you're thinking about, oh, is this the right way? Should I put that word before that word? And it's just the things that don't really matter, because, you know, what I've learned through writing is that you can edit something that's bad, but you can't edit something that hasn't been written, you know.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. And there's a kind of, there's a spirit in things that you can feel, even if they're not technically brilliant, when I'm editing for other people. And you can feel that when something's formulaic and someone has written it in a very, you know, left brain's like structure, and right brain's the other way around. I can't remember. Anyway, you know, sometimes I'm working on stuff which I'm editing, which is all works, but there's a kind of a spirit missing from it because they've planned it and they've structured it and they've thought about it. And I think that what I realize is that any of us who are disciplined and any of us who work hard can sort of make things happen. But to get into a magic area, which is what I'm interested in now, you can't do that by holding on to everything. You have to let go, and you have to be in a free flow at some point. And that means with crew and cast and in whatever creative part of the process you're in. Purely forcing things into a box doesn't breed that magical entity, and that's where I aspire to be. Yeah.
Hey.
it's me, Evita from the future. I just wanted to check in on you. Are you staying hydrated, caffeinated, and most importantly, enjoying the show? If so, why not take a screenshot right now? Slap it up on your Instagram story and tag us at Making It Women of Film. I will personally come thank you and share it on our story. This season, we really want to incorporate you listeners into the show. You're the reason we're still doing this, which is why, from now on, we'll give two random follow shoutouts every episode. All you have to do is follow us on Instagram, tag us in a post, and you might be chosen. We also want to hear from you if you have any feedback. So, if you have anything you want to say, anything you want to listen to more, anything you don't want to listen to, any questions you have for our guest or for us, you can email us at miwif.feedback@gmail.com. Now, good luck and thanks for listening. Now, let's get back into the interview.
Yeah, and as someone who's been in this industry for a while, I mean, I'm sure you're experienced and know, like, what it is the market wants and things like that, what's desirable. How do you, like...
Well, that's a hard thing to navigate, because I think, like the not waking up and judging yourself at 5 a.m. thing, I think people are always saying, what's the market? What is this thing for? And I think the artist's only true calling can be to create. It doesn't mean that you are stupid and are creating something that has no sellability. But at the same time, if you think about that first, you can't create. You have to write what's in your heart or what's important to you, whether that's politically, socially, environmentally, whatever it is that you feel you need to express, because otherwise you may as well do something else, because it's not going to necessarily work anyways, double guessing what the market wants. Might have moved on by the time, you know, okay, everything's, you know, Ghostbusters this week. Okay, so you write a ghost film, and then everything next week is Marvel, and then Marvel's out of fashion, and then suddenly it's alternative film, and you know, then it's all, you know, guns and wars. You just can't. The only thing the artist can do is to try and be truthful and create something that means something to them, while having in mind that an audience is going to watch this. It's not, I don't write something just thinking to entertain myself, you know. So there is an element to knowing that there has to be a beginning, a middle, and an end, and there has to be a story, and there needs to be, your character has to move and change and grow, and has to be something a little different in a way that no one's seen it before, if you can manage it, you know.
How do you feel about limitations in forms of structure and story points?
Like, I've done a lot of low budget filmmaking with the intention to make a feature and to make it with friends, or to sign it, and it's low budget, so it's not too big a proposition and economically viable. I think that you can find a lot of creativity within a discipline of, you know, setting some parameters. But I also think that if you're purely a writer, not a writer-director or writer-producer-director or whatever you are, I think if you're just a writer, I think it's better to write what you want to write, not think about the budget. I think that we can't double-guess where the audience is going to flow to. You know, who thought Squid Games would be a massive hit? And I think there's a difference between being a jobbing writer and being a show creator or a content creator, and neither one is better or worse, because just like me working as an actor on Home and Away, I then worked at Sydney Theatre Company and did The Crucible. So it's not that one is better or worse, it's just different, and you do things at different phases in your life and different times in your life, and all that feeds into the picture of your artistic history, and that's what makes you who you are. So whether you're jobbing as a writer if you're privileged enough to get into a writer's room, and because that's really hard to do, and you find yourself gaining in experience and losing in creativity somehow for your own show creation, then that's probably a problem, and that's a phase, and then you're going to come out the other side of it. I do think there's merit in everything. I think there's some people not to start with a blank piece of paper, as I do, and not know where it's going, like Sorkin. Other people are very disciplined and structured, and that's the technically correct way to do it, you know, like John August and Craig Mazin, and the way they talk about stuff. I think everyone's different and there is no path in this industry, and that's what's tricky, is that you really want some path, and there's only in the creative arts, there's only the path that you end up on, and there's no right or wrong. Working on a soap is not right or wrong. Working only in theatre is not right or wrong. Show creation is for some people, not for others. Other people are much happier writing episodic television that they haven't created and feeding their families, you know, because it comes to a point in people's lives when they're a little bit older, when they've got kids or something, and they want a steady income. So I don't think there's any right or wrong in any of this, and it's just what suits you at that moment, and it might change the next minute, you know?
Not precisely. What inspires you when you're writing?
It's hard to know. I mean, I write different things and I've written different genres. What I've started to notice a pattern, and it's not always true, but I like to start with a seed of an extraordinary, real story. Not always, but sometimes I go down these rabbit holes and I find something and go, oh my God, that's an amazing idea. Why doesn't anyone know about this? Usually I take that true story, the incidents that happen, and then I fictionalize the characters and change the name of the town, or I change the location because for legal reasons, but also because it's entertainment, you know, so that it's much easier to write really entertaining characters if you're not trying to stick purely to the truth of the character, not the incidents. That's not always the case. Sometimes I've written sci-fi and I've written political thrillers, but the show I'm working on at the moment was inspired by a true story. And it's a nice place to start, because if you find something that's true that seems unbelievable, you know, I always feel like fact is so much true and funnier than fiction, you know, most of the time. I'm in these situations all the time where if I was the editor and I wrote that something that happened to me that day, I'd go, that couldn't happen. That's too preposterous. That's too easy. I think if you can find something true, and this is only for me, doesn't mean you have to stick to the absoluteness of that truth, but it's definitely an inspiration point for me often.
How do you then feel about that kind of merging between the fiction and the nonfiction?
I'm more there for the creative process of finding often the things that come out with the characters. If you start with a true story and it's just an incredible story, for example, at the moment I'm writing a series about a tiny Italian town that was experiencing spontaneous combustion for over a decade. And it's not very well known. So all of the incidents that I've used in the television series happened, but I fictionalized the characters and changed the name of the town. Because what I found was that the scenarios were so bizarre, you know, it was funny, but maybe I didn't think it was necessarily fair to dramatize the real people. So although all the actual incidents happened, I've created and some of the characters sort of close to something that felt real from the interviews and things that I read. But it's entertainment too. And I mean, what I'm writing at the moment currently is definitely entertainment. So it's not, I'm not trying to make a serious hardcore drama. I'm not doing a documentary. So it's really fun because you've got this great starting jumping off point, you know, and then to allow your own imagination to explore what that might be and how those characters might have spoken to each other is really fun.
Spontaneous combustion is a very interesting thing. I remember I listened to from a paranormal podcast about like the concept. I was like, that happened. That's fascinating. How did you come across that?
I went down a rabbit hole. I was looking for something and I found this tiny little line in this article and I thought, oh my God, really? And then I couldn't really find very much on it. And then I found a few really good articles. And then I found a little bit more and a little bit more. And then a journalist who'd experienced it with them. It seemed really controversial because they never really knew what happened. And there was a lot of elements to this story. So that's always really fun when there's competing forces who think they know why the spontaneous combustion happened. And actually nobody really knows. Something about there was a kind of a belief system with the people about the devil coming through the power lines, them turning off the power to the village, and the government calling a state of emergency and the Vatican getting involved and NASA scientists and all sorts of things, and then the alien boffins descending on the Earth, but they thought it was aliens. So I thought that was a really interesting kind of analogy for alternative information right now and what our conspiracies are and what we choose to believe and how we choose to, you know, how we get our information. So behind the kind of fun of, and there's a kind that I'm exploring other territory that's kind of a bit deeper and darker behind the fun usually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you believe in aliens?
I don't not believe in aliens. I mean, it would be preposterous to think that out of all these millions of galaxies that we're the only life, but I'm not like a big, you know, I'm not looking out my window every night for aliens. You know, it's, I mean, I'm kind of more open to that than other things that most people are open to. But I know I'm not somebody who follows loads of alien conspiracies and things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always find interesting something about like spontaneous combustion, where it's like something that a lot of people have reported, right, throughout like many decades in history, and you're like, there has to be something there, right, like when it comes to aliens, ghosts, whichever paranormal experience it is. And a lot of them have obviously been debunked, but at the same time, it's something that continues to happen and has happened for so long. I just find it fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's really funny. But I mean, I haven't, in my series, I haven't chosen a particular stance. It's just I'm allowing those great characters who want, you know, somebody believed that, well, there was an American military base and they believed that it was all microwave technology that the military were testing on the place, and then others believed it was aliens, and then others thought the devil was coming through the power lines. And so I think that's fascinating when there's something that nobody can truly explain, but people are really convinced about it. The world we're living in right now, right? So you have anti-vaxxers and vaccine fanatics, and you have Donald Trump supporters, and you have, you know, Brexiteers, and, you know, all this kind of, for me, that feels like kind of fanaticism, and we don't have a way of finding a middle ground anymore. There's no common ground, and if you're one, you're not the other, and it's really divided. And so I think in some respects I'm kind of in my own way trying to show that kind of division in a fun, palatable way.
Mm-hmm. So do you like to be kind of like that third person observer?
I think you feel your own hand in everything you're writing. It's really nice when you don't. And I think that thing I was talking about waking up at 5 a.m., that's the time when I'm not as likely to feel my own hand in things. It's like some sort of magical experience. And it sounds wanky to say all that, but it really, I love writing. And I, you know, when I'm in a really good phase, I can't wait to wake up in the morning and find out what's going to happen. Not that I don't have a structure, and not that I don't, I mean, I think if you're writing a television series, you have to have a structure and you have to know kind of where you're going. And I'm really glad I had a show Bible that I created before I started writing it. With films, I sometimes like to not know, which is totally the wrong thing to do technically, but it's what I like. And so my first draft is often kind of like a working out thing, and then I have to go back in and put the tent poles in. But with a television series, it's too big, and you have to do the work beforehand or you get lost.
Mm-hmm. No, everyone has a completely different process, and I think it's very interesting when people let themselves find that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're starting out, everyone's different again, but I think when I was starting out, I didn't want to do the planning. I wanted to just have the fun of the writing, and there's a part of me that's still a little bit like that, but more and more I kind of do believe you do want to know your ending. You probably do. Or if you're going to do what I call a vomit draft.
Oh, then, I love the vomit drafts.
Yeah. So you're then finding out your ending, and then you're going to go back in and do a huge amount of reworking. Craig Mazin and Joel and August would smack me for that.
Shout out to Script Notes. Good podcast.
Yeah, the podcast. Yeah, they go. I love that show. Really love it. Oh, I'm sorry. I should mention it on here, but
no, me too. Yeah, me too. They're great. Yeah, I think it's just very interesting to talk with all other writers because it is something that isn't so practical in the same way as like sound recording or like obviously everyone has a different process, but it's something that comes out of you in such a different way because it's you, you know. It's kind of, I guess it's, how do you feel? Do you think there's any kind of connection between acting and writing?
I think the more script editing I do for other people, though, I realize that you can't teach people how to write dialogue. You either can do it or you can't. I mean, you can get better at it probably, but I think often if you've come from an acting background, you think more internally about you follow the characters rather than following. The plot comes from the characters more often. That's what I notice when I'm script editing other actors who are writers. I just read a friend of mine's, quite a well-known actor, asked me to feedback on their script, and his dialogue was so good. And it's because, you know, he really knows, he can just feel that intuitively. Not that I'm the person to follow, but you can, because I do a lot of script editing for others, you can teach the formula of writing as far as, you know, what a slug line should look like. And it's amazing how many people don't know when they start writing, and you can teach more precise action points. But I think true dialogue and true inspiration for something quite original, it just comes from within the person. And I feel like there is a part of that you can't teach. You can nurture people, but, you know, it comes from within themselves.
As long as you make something that you love, it will find a home eventually. There will be people out there. It's a big world. It's a big world. And the likelihood that no one is interested in your project is very low. And also just finding the way to tell that in a way that people can connect with. And it doesn't need to be like the people, as in like, again, one entity, the people. I find that so interesting because it's like, people have very different interests in movies, and some have very wide interests and some have very narrow interests. And it's just, I think it's, yeah, there'll be a home for it, yeah.
Your film can get into London Film Festival, so it's already going to be pretty good because, you know, it's a very competitive field. And you can go in with your peers and just be blown away by a film, and you come out other people going, that was rubbish. And you think, we just see the same film? You know, and really the other way around. So I think it's the other thing about being a creator is that you have to do what you feel, because you can't please everyone. And the space that we're in now with all the streamers means that something that might have been a very niche film, that niche becomes a big audience when you have the whole world to film it to, you know, to show it to. So something that might have been really tough to get away in a cinematic release becomes, you know, something that, and I think now the super spreaders, not in film and television, is word of mouth. It's not necessarily just through publicity. That's what's changed. You know, you're in a dinner party, you say, what are you watching? And that's how you find out what your next television show is going to be. And that's a real shift. That's a real shift.
Yeah. Exactly. And also for any filmmakers listening, if you make a divisive movie, I think that's also an accomplishment. I think that's really fun to disagree about movies, because there isn't an objective thing on, like, obviously some movies you're like, okay, like, but that's a very small amount. But I think it's very interesting if there's a movie I love and something someone else just couldn't get into, and I know that there's probably a version of me who would have watched that at a different time and couldn't have gotten into it. And it's, yeah.
I think a lot of what our impressions on films is sometimes when we don't realize the mood we're in when we see it, and the headspace, and maybe the expectation, depending on how much publicity or not that you've read. I like to go and see stuff as much as possible without reading anything about it. I mean, it's really hard if you're in the industry, because by osmosis you hear things, but I really try not to read anything about anything before I see it. I really try hard.
No, yeah, I stopped watching trailers about a few months ago. Stop reading synopsis. I see someone say you should watch parallel mothers and I see that it's playing and I go watch it and I enjoy it. Or I just like that blind experience. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun because I've been misled too many times and now I just want the movie to tell me what it is on its own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Nicola, it's been really great talking with you, having this introspective conversation about writing and art in a consumerist world and also how, you know, you navigate that as a writer. Is there a woman in the film industry that you'd like to give a shout out to who inspires you?
I've got so many. I don't know if I can choose one, because even in my own life, there's been, you know, I've had very inspiring people around me. I was mentored by Lee Magaday, who produced The Favourite and The Lobster, and she was terrific with me. And then that mentorship was a women in film and television mentorship, and I was on that with really brilliant women. So so many of them are doing brilliant things right now. And like Ida O'Brien, who started the whole intimacy coaching, and Ida, who's the post-production producer for the whole of Game of Thrones, yada, 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 yada. So there's so many people who, you know, I've worked with and I find inspiring. And sometimes I find, you know, people who are not that well known really inspiring, just depending on what their story is and how they've come into the industry. And I think there's some great young women coming through who are doing really terrific stuff that's inspiring. You know, there's a whole kind of new wave of female young, not even just young, just new. It doesn't mean young, but new.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Nicola. Is there anything you want to plug, promote? Where can people find you, support your work?
I've got a small company called Rocket Room Films. I've just signed a co-production deal with Story First, which is Michael Grade and Peter Gerwig's company, and my EPs and all the guys there, Dominic Barlow, Tom Davidson, Henry Clifford, all of them are terrific. And we're sort of working on the show together, Combustione. So I guess I'm really, you know, that's out to cast at the moment. So that's really exciting. Yeah, and there's a few other things on the horizon which I can't really announce yet, but that's, you know, I guess Combustion is the thing that I really want to happen, because I've written, I'm on the last episode writing it now. It's been a really fantastic experience with Robbie Del Maestro, who was also my mentor, who's now my collaborator, who I was working with through Directors UK. So I think maybe I should shout out to Directors UK and Women in Film and Television, who've been incredibly supportive and provided all sorts of resources that in this unnavigatable industry have helped provide some basis or foundation for support.
Making It Women in Film is hosted by Malin Evita, produced in collaboration with her and Redeeming Features. Our production supervisor is Ruth Aitken. Research is by Lauren San Miguel. Shania Bethune and Abby Weiss are our production assistants. If you enjoy our show, please remember to subscribe and leave a review. You can also support the show by posting about us on your social media and following us on Instagram at Making It Women in Film. If you have any questions or feedback, DM us or email us at miwif.feedback@gmail.com. For more, visit womeninfilm.co.uk or redeemingfeatures.co.uk. Everything will be linked down in the show notes. Thank you, and we'll see you next Tuesday for another episode of Making It Women in Film.